This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. Man, it feels good to say that again. I'm Jake Neer of Automotive News, who OG fans might remember as the former co-host of Mishmash, filling in for Shayna Roth this and next week. The UAW strike is now 4 weeks old, and ever more twists and turns as time passes. Now that we're about a month in, it's a good time, I think, to take a step back and look at the overall strategy and how it is playing out. A lot could change in just a few hours from where we sit right here as we record this, but to help us reflect a bit on the past 4 weeks and what we've seen is Professor of Business at Wayne State University, Merrick Masters. He's an expert in labor relations and negotiations, and very happy to have him joining us here today. Merrick Masters, welcome to Mishmash.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
So, Sean Fain, very different president that we've seen at the UAW in quite a long time, and he's taking a very different strategy here in these negotiations. First of all, give us a brief sort of rundown of what's different about his strategy and how you think it's been working now that we've sort of seen how he intends to make this stand-up strike work.
Well, his strategy is different in two major respects from what his predecessors have used. Number one, it's different in approach in that he's changed the process so it's no longer focused on a single company targeted. And if you have a strike, it's a company-wide strike and you use the ultimate agreement that you reach with that company as a model to take the other two. He has instead engaged in simultaneously bargaining with all three, reserving the option all along to strike asymmetrically or concurrently, and he's done a combination of both. And we're now approaching the fifth week of the strike, and obviously it has succeeded in enabling him to get some concessions from the companies to the union that might not have been forthcoming otherwise. And his strategy is different in that I would say it's multi-pronged. He's really focused a lot on building public support, using social media as a means of capturing the narrative, and also inviting outside parties, including the President of the United States, to make their support for the union known. And he's turned this in very much into a battle of good versus evil. He's certainly vented against the billionaires and the elite class and the rich, what he claims really basically have no use for the typical auto worker. They're not the kind of people they want to have dinner with or invite to their yacht. And said basically things like that and saying that this is really a struggle for the working class and it's broader than the UAW. And that's why we're holding out for as much as we can possibly get to rebalance things.
Early this week, things seemed kind of quiet, you know, as sort of a change of pace that, you know, we had been seeing statements coming from both the UAW and the Detroit 3 on a pretty regular basis in the weeks leading up to that. But then suddenly it seemed like things were getting a little bit more quiet. And then Sean Fain announces that the UAW is expanding the strike to Kentucky Truck Plant, which is Ford's probably most important plant in the U.S. Talk about that as sort of a feature of Sean Fain's strategy and sort of how it illustrates where they're going here.
Well, it ratchets it up the economic consequence of the strike considerably. This particular plan accounts for about 16% of the production in the first 8 months of Ford. And overall, the strikes at the Ford plants account for about 34% of their production in the first 8 months. This plant accounts for about 23% of its North American revenue in 2022. 8,700 workers are involved, and Ford has released a statement indicating that about 100,000 workers in the Ford and supplier network are impacted by this strike, so there could be subsequent layoffs and additional fallout associated with this. So it is significant economically. It ratchets up, as I said, the pressure on the companies. And it forebodes something about what he might be doing in the future, consistent with his strategy of mixing things up. This week he mixed it up in terms of he didn't rely on the traditional wait until Friday to announce another phase of the strike. This time he did it sort of instantaneously and threw the company off balance in that regard. And I would expect that he has more tricks, so to speak, like that up his sleeve that he's going to play to maximize the points of leverage that he has.
When we were chatting a little bit before we were recording, you sort of likened what he's doing to Sun Tzu's Art of War. Talk a little bit about that and also maybe the public nature of these negotiations.
Well, let's take them both because they work hand in glove.
Sure.
What you want to do is weaken your opposition as much as possible. And you do that by creating internal discord. And he's done that essentially by forcing the companies to compete against each other and to have to defend themselves in the media, putting them on the defensive. So they have to go out and now justify why executives make so much money, why they got a 40% raise over the past several years and more than their workers got. And yet they're claiming that their workers don't deserve a 40% raise. It puts them, you know, in a difficult spot for the public. There are just a lot more of your typical workers than there are high paid executives. And public opinion is going to galvanize behind those in a Goliath and David struggle. It's going to, you know, pivot towards David. But this is a different sort of thing that he's doing, where he's using the social media to not only attack his opponents, but also to build the case that he thinks that this is for a fair and just transition. And that got the attention of the Biden administration, who has been pursuing electrical vehicles with great vigor, but knowing that a lot of the means by which the big three use to pursue them, joint ventures, do not pay the so-called UAW wage, and that's created a sense of inequity in the system, and they don't like the bias of policy that favors that. And so they got the president of the United States to come and visit their picket line, which was a historic moment and something I think that told a lot of people that you've got, when you have people in the White House listening to you, you've got to realize that that's an important element of support that you can call upon in the future.
I was interested about that. You know, Sean Fain had said in one of his Facebook Live events, almost in passing, just a couple days before Joe Biden came to town, you know, maybe the president of the United States should come and show his support for workers on the picket line. And then within, you know, 24 or 48 hours, we got the announcement Joe Biden will be in town to join the picket line. I'm wondering if, I mean, this might just be speculation, but the thought had come into my head. I wonder if Sean Fain knew already that Joe Biden was coming to town, because it was so quick, you know, that it was surprising to me. I mean, it seems like you don't just organize a presidential visit that suddenly.
Well, presidents can do what they want to do in a hurry if
That's
they
true.
Want to do it in a hurry. And so he can travel on the spur of a moment. And this was not a heavy lift in the sense that they didn't have to have a big rally and have all sorts of other dignitaries mm-hmm. come and orchestrate that. He just had to show up at a picket line, which is a non-trivial event, but make a few remarks and then hand the mic over to Sean Fain, which is what he did. So I'm certain that in the back of his mind, Sean Fain had to think that if he makes this invitation, that it's going to be very hard for the most pro-union president in American history to say, I'm not coming. And I think that he, said, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. And he took the offer.
Yeah.
And he knew that he was in that position. And I think that, you know, to his credit, but President Biden's credit, he didn't have to do it. He did do it. And he didn't come here and trounce the companies. He didn't say anything bad about them. He just said that the workers have a case and they deserve what they're asking. And he wishes, you know, the parties good luck in getting the best agreement possible. So I think he did what he needed to do from a standpoint politically and public policy wise, because he wants as much support for his climate change, Green Deal policies as possible and knows.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That he's got to have union workers behind them.
Recently, we spoke with Stephen Ratner, the former auto czar under President Obama, who, of course, was involved in the negotiations to help keep GM and Chrysler, GM and Chrysler afloat in 2009. He said that the union has to be careful that they don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg, so to speak, by asking for too much. We're at a point right now where it seems like the automakers are essentially saying, you know, we're really getting to the point where we can't make many more concessions. What are your thoughts about sort of what Stephen Ratner is saying there about maybe the unintended consequences of getting too good a deal, I guess you could say, that negatively affects the union?
Well, sometimes you got to be careful and you might get what you wish for and rue the day that you actually got it. And so I think that they need to be mindful that in getting a good deal, whatever that may be in their estimation, you don't risk the company's future. And I think the companies at the same time have an obligation to say effectively that they're not going to make such a deal. And if it requires getting the president to intervene somehow or another to get the parties to come to their senses and avoid that circumstance, then I think that they should behind the scenes work towards that kind of an outcome, because so much is at stake. The companies, rightly or wrongly, are under heavy pressure from policymakers to produce electrical vehicles. And this is not something necessarily that they have chosen to do at this speed of their own accord. It's something that's been, to a large extent, imposed upon them, although they have willingly gone along and said they're in favor of it and they buy the argument of the need to do it for climate change mitigation purposes. At the same time, they have to realize that this is expensive and they don't have as much money to allocate to labor as they might have otherwise. And therefore, they've got to be cautious going forward and they've got to make their business case to the union, to the public, and to policymakers. And I think they have a good case to make. I don't necessarily think they've made the greatest job portraying the case. It isn't that they haven't tried to get it out. It's just that it's got lost in the hyperbole. It's got lost in the infatuation with the new strategy and the media script, which is largely that labor is on the rise. All this activism is, you know, a social good, and therefore we ought to welcome it. I tend to believe that labor is just in trying to reclaim its rightful position in this capitalistic society and ask for a larger share. And we've seen decades of stagnating wages while the rich have gotten wealthier. And so I think people understandably are concerned about the inequities in society growing in nature, where you essentially have societies moving into a have and have not categories. And labor unions are a way of countervailing that, and I think that's a healthy thing.
On that note, in my mind, it seems like Sean Fain, as president of the UAW, obviously he has to be focused on these specific labor negotiations, but it seems like, to me at least, his entire strategy and the way he's approaching this goes beyond this set of contracts alone, that, you know, there's a bigger statement he's trying to make. There's a bigger galvanization that's going along with this. And it's coming at a time, as you said, when, as we like to say in the media lately, the labor movement is having a moment. You can sort of take a lot of different angles on that statement. But either way, there's at least the sense that there's some energy behind it. Do you buy that this is sort of maybe a defining moment for where labor goes in the future, and that's why Sean Fain is doing some of the things he's doing?
Yes, they call it a generationally defining moment. And I think that language was chosen very carefully. And Peter Drucker also wrote about this one time about union leaders several decades ago, in which he said that most union leaders climb through the ranks and are good organizational citizens. And that means that they are concerned about the future of the institution. And in Sean Fain's mind and other people of his mindset, he's going to ask the question, what is the purpose of the UAW? What is the purpose of a union institution? And it's to represent working people and to fight for working people. And that's what he's going to pursue. And that puts them into a larger role in society about balancing the power between labor and capital, which is an age-old consideration. So we're seeing now this play out in real time with a different twist than we're used to, because we've gotten rather complacent and used to a rather tame labor movement compared to the history of the labor movement in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And it's going to take some getting used to, but I think that the only way that we can really begin to rebalance the forces between labor and capital and get more into the pocketbook of workers is if there's this kind of fight and struggle that takes place. But you don't want it to be an irresponsible, foolish fight that put society at a risk or that seek some sort of a different kind of outcome that is revolutionary in nature that would destroy a large part of our society and the factors in it that generate economic wealth, because the only way we're really going to improve a lot of people is if we can generate more wealth. And that's a given. And so we've got to find ways to balance labor's desire for more against companies' need to have as much as they possibly can to invest.
I also wonder if there is a attempt to realign the UAW with the broader labor movement in some ways that we've talked before about, again, this energy around labor, you know, has a lot to do with the new organizing efforts. You know, we've talked about Starbucks, we've talked about Amazon, all these like renewed efforts to organize. And the UAW, especially under the former president Ray Curry and then his predecessors who are, you know, have been indicted for essentially being in cahoots with the companies in some way or another, as an old labor sort of sector that isn't really aligned with this energy that we are seeing with the more high profile organizing efforts and the younger people and that sort of thing. But with Sean Fain, it seems like there is more alignment it seems like one of his goals might be to be like, hey, we're as populist as you are here. we want to be riding that same wave and in some ways creating the wave.
Well, I think that hits the nail on the head, that what we've seen evolve over time in recent decades is that labor has moved more closely to management. It's really been the epitome of what we call business unionism, in which essentially labor buys into the same goals of management and acts in the sense of being directed towards what they can do to help management perform its job within its limited capacity of representing labor. Sean Fain takes a different approach to that and says, well, we are a separate institution, independent of management, and we have different interests and different needs to serve, and we are obligated to articulate those. And in fact, that, in their judgment, is the way the National Labor Relations Act was set up, to provide a mechanism in which they could make their case to management and had economic powers granted under the law, such as a strike, to force management to make concessions. So this is really a balancing act in which the union will articulate its views. But he was clear from the very beginning the days of a cozy relationship with management are over, and it's been echoed in harsher terms. One of his vice presidents, one of the union's international vice presidents, said that when one of the companies calls us family, remember, we're not family. And so I think that lays it on the line. And, you know, unions, when they negotiate, this is an old idea of labor relations scholarship, that they try to structure the attitudes of the parties. And they try and question sometimes the legitimacy of the point of view of the other side. And the union's basically saying that as far as it's concerned, they think management has hoarded profits and used them to buy back stocks and give dividends rather than to give it more to workers or invest in workers in terms of higher wages. And also that you can't trust management because they'll tell you one thing one day and then the next day, you know, they're closing a plant. And also that we have different interests, and we're not necessarily always intended to be friendly. And so, you know, it's just like Republicans and Democrats fighting things out, or two lawyers in a courtroom. They'll fight it out. That's the nature of their job. Litigation is an adversarial system. And some say labor relations involves issues which are put in conflict, and you've got to find a way through collective bargaining to resolve them.
I think I used the phrase indicted to refer to former UAW officials who were involved in that scheme. And I should have used the word convicted and sentenced in this case, former President Gary Jones.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that to some extent they were involved in misappropriating funds from the joint training centers, which were set up to help the union, help the companies, train workers to be more productive and better at quality. And then these morphed into different types of organizations that funded all kinds of things that really didn't have anything to do with training. And then they became sort of these very tempting pots of money with lax controls that both on the corporate and the management side to varying degrees, corporate and the union side, were abused for personal gain. And the supposition, to some extent, that they were also used to buy a certain tone in labor management relations that was more conciliatory.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about a recent article in USA Today in which you said the UAW and the Detroit Three automakers have common interests. What are those commonalities in your mind, and who's conceding the most during these negotiations on those?
Well, I think thus far the companies have conceded more, but the unions had a very high ask. And so in order to get a deal, you've got to give a lot. I think that was clear from the very beginning. And so I think that when you look at that, from that standpoint, the unions have had the upper hand, but I think we're getting close to the resistance point, and there's only so much more the companies can go without the union giving something.
And in terms of their commonalities, the things that they can both get out of this?
Well, the commonalities, they obviously have a common interest in sustaining the company's viability, which means that they can provide jobs, good paying jobs, and benefits for those employees. That's critical. And I think for the point of view of American competitiveness, they both have an interest in making certain that we remain competitive in manufacturing and that we can produce these value-adding jobs. The multiplier effect of the automobile industry, it's 1 to 7, 1 in 10. That's huge. So when you have jobs that like this that can potentially add so much value to the economy, this is the kind of investment we want to make as a society and have more of, so that we can raise everybody's boat rather than just having a part of society enjoy the material wealth that we create.
I'll let you have the last word here. Anything you want to leave our audience with to think about as we're watching the rest of these events unfold over the next days and weeks?
Well, I would say there's a deal that can be made and there's a deal that will be made, and that it will require problem solving. It will require some creativity and flexibility, but that the union has already won a lot. And I would go back to echoing what Steve Rattner said, that you don't want to, you know, get such a win that you damage the future. And I think that both sides have an obligation to be mindful of that.
Merrick Masters, professor of business at Wayne State University, thank you so much for joining us on Mishmash. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Take care and have a good day, sir.
This is Mishmash. I'm Jake Neer in for Shayna Roth. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. And of course, big shout out to Hearns Laguerre Jr. for his help producing today's episode. If you listen to the podcast and you want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review, or you can support WDET. Just go to wdet.org/give. I'm Jake Neer with Automotive News, in for Shayna Roth. Thanks so much for listening.